This is Super Yacht Radio.
Welcome to Super Yacht Radio, and welcome to the series of Seize the Mind, where I'm here, Maeve, in Dublin, and I will be chatting over the next few weeks with Emma.
Hi, I'm Emma Ross. I am a mental health first aider with Seize the Mind and Kelly's Cause, and we are going to be talking about topics around mental health and raising some awareness of mental health in yachting.
I have the pleasure of speaking with Emma Ross, who has been working with Kelly's Calls and is also a, can I say, longtime yachtie as well. So I'm very much looking forward to this series and learning more myself and sharing this valuable information with all of you listeners over the next couple of months. Emma, lovely to have you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's really lovely to be here.
So we're beginning, Emma, with the topic of stigma, which I have to say, as I looked into it, it brings in so many different parts of how we perceive things and therefore how we kind of deal with mental health when we get there. Can you begin us off by kind of defining what stigma actually means when we're talking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, stigma basically involves the kind of negative attitudes or any unconscious or conscious prejudice and discrimination that refers to negative behavior. There is a stigma associated with mental ill health specifically. And the problem with stigma is it has so many negative effects. It may lead people to hide their difficulties. It may lead to people not talking about their condition. And that is the big problem that we have with it. We have stigma that stops conversations, and we have discrimination, which brings in unconscious biases into those conversations. So, you know, I am a trained mental health first aider. And at Mental Health First Aid, we kind of learn that, you know, stigma and discrimination are really widespread. They're really damaging, and that language matters when we're having conversations around mental health and mental ill health.
And can I add additionally for the yachting community, another thing strikes me is we are a very international community with lots of different cultures. And even within our own cultures, there are certain stigmas that are more apparent in some more than others. So I would imagine in the yachting community, it affects us in different ways only because there's so many different cultures involved.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The more cultures you have, the less kind of cohesive understanding you have of a subject. And normally, you know, in kind of subjects that are positive, it's great to have all of those different understandings, all those different cultural experiences, all those people's different lived experiences coming into a giant melting pot of yachting and then the wider frame of super yachting. The problem is when it comes to things like mental health, we don't know necessarily the language to use. We don't know how to start the conversations. And if we don't know how to start the conversations, we can't break the stigma and we can't raise awareness about stuff. So having all of those kind of the melting pot of cultures is fabulous in one way, and we've all seen the benefits of it and lived the benefits of it as yachties. But then also there's another way of looking at it, which is something that we just want to highlight now.
Kind of starting on that, I did some research about Ireland, actually, because there's not that much information about this topic in our yachting community. But in Ireland, oddly enough, at the moment, we are battling our history of stigmas. We've had, you know, a lot of issues about the mother and baby situation that ran through Ireland for decades. And mental health is, and I think UK would probably be similar, is also something that people have been very slow to open up to and talk about, even, you know, from my generation, not even the generation before me. And they did some research in Ireland back in 2007 when a support network called Sea of Change began. And 60% of people at that stage wouldn't want anyone to know that they had a mental health problem. 10 years on, that went down, but it would still be 4 out of 10 people would conceal from friends and colleagues and other people that they had a mental health problem. And I found that, you know, interesting statistic, even though it's positive, there has been a change, that's still close to half the population who wouldn't feel comfortable sharing when they were, you know, mentally not feeling strong.
Yeah. And that's a devastating kind of sobering statistic. It's the problem we have is that we have, and I don't know if this is from media, I don't know if we kind of unconsciously we've been fed so many kind of lies and hysterical kind of understandings of what mental ill health is. You know, you see newspaper headlines saying psycho killer, schizo, and that kind of language seeps into our consciousness and it frightens us a little bit. So why would you want to ever admit to something when it is so scary and so frightening in the media, and that's our perception of it? And that's our understanding of it. So that stops people having conversations. And for some reason, and I still don't know why, and I'm obviously guilty of this until I became an instructor, until I became, like, you know, involved in the whole mental health first aid arena, is that for some reason, as a society, we have a completely different relationship to our physical health and to our mental health. When it comes to physical health, we can discuss our ailments, we can, you know, break a limb or hurt ourselves or get stomach flu, and we can talk about the signs, the symptoms, we can talk about our recovery process, we can talk about going to the doctors to get something checked out. In fact, it's encouraged to do that. You know, it's encouraged by our friends and family, it's encouraged by public health messages. So we have this really great relationship with and connectivity with our physical health. And it should be the same with mental health. Like in the world that I want to create, I want people to be able to talk about going to a therapist after suffering from a bout of depression or from, you know, grieving the loss of someone or that's died, or even potentially like the death of a relationship after a breakup. You know, it's okay to take some time out to recover, to look after yourself, to apply self-care. And that's where we want it to kind of go. So yeah, like having all these conversations, breaking the stigma, raising the awareness is the first step, I believe, into doing stuff like that.
Just to move back to a little bit more to language, you know, it was one of the things I think we're not even aware of, because there are certain phrases that have been used so often in a jokey way, you know, he's a bit nutty or she's loony, or, you know, we use them often just sort of in a jokey way. But, you know, we've had this discussion of when you really get down to it, if you also think of I'm feeling very down, when people talk about suicide, and you mentioned this to me, you'd say, well, they were successful. You know, there's a lot of language that is used that we're not even necessarily aware of how we use it.
Absolutely. I mean, when we're talking about suicide, the phrase that we commonly use is that person committed suicide. And if you think about the language commit, what else do you commit? You commit a crime. That's the phrase that you think of. You commit suicide and you commit a crime. And the reason it's called said you say commit is because it used to be a crime. Until the Suicide Act of 1961, I believe, came through, if you or a member of your family attempted or completed suicide, there would be either jail time or fines involved, either for the person who hadn't completed suicide or their family members. So there you are, you're kind of going through the worst period of your life. And if you don't complete your suicide, you're then liable to be fined or incur some jail time. I mean, it was just a horrific kind of set of circumstances. Thankfully, that's now, because of the Suicide Act, that's now changed and it's not a criminal act, but the language still remains. You commit suicide. So at Mental Health First Aid, what we try and talk about is just slowly, incrementally thinking about language and thinking how much it matters and changing that commit suicide to complete suicide and changing the, you know, the successful suicides. You know, they had tried to complete suicide, but they were unsuccessful, meaning they lived, well, that's not unsuccessful to me. That's a great success. There's a person still alive because they didn't do that. So yeah, just these kind of tiny changes. And there's some really interesting exercises that we do. It's one is called like a graffiti wall exercise. And what it asks the person to do, or what it asks the delegates to do, is we get them to write, you know, negative, kind of bad, really kind of like derogatory words related to mental ill health. And we get them to write positive or neutral or kind of like good words related to it. And what we find overwhelmingly in all of the classes that we teach is that you can fill up a piece of paper with a negative word easily. It just kind of flows out of us, even from good, well-intentioned people. We just have that, those negative words ready to kind of like unleash because we've heard them so often. And it's much harder to think of positive or neutral words. I mean, we can do it. It just requires a bit more effort. So yeah, that's part of what we kind of want to instill in people, is thinking about language and getting that slow incremental change to something that's more positive, more neutral. And it's important here as well to think of, again, that link between physical health and mental health. If someone, you know, breaks their arm, or I'm going to use that as an example, if someone breaks their arm, as I did 5 years ago, I'm not the girl with the broken arm. I'm Emma Kate Ross. You would never make that distinction. And yet we have this kind of permanence that occurs with mental ill health. If I had suffered from depression as I did for many years, you know, I'm kind of almost known as, you know, the girl with depression. And that doesn't occur in any of the kind of physical ailments that we have. Why should it occur with any of the mental health ailments that we have? Because I've done the work, I've done the recovery, I go to therapy, I practice self-care. So I'm in a much better state now. So I was someone who experienced, past tense, I experienced depression. I am not like a depressive full time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Ties in with the concept of, you know, labels, how labels can be attached to things, and particularly in the case of this, negative labels. You know, I think there's also for those that are going through it, there's this incredible pressure of what's wrong with me? Why can't I just get on with it? I'm not strong enough. You know, it brings in all these negative aspects, which, you know, is synonymous when you're feeling depressed or really anxious, or because it unfortunately isn't as visible often. You know, broken arm is visible. You can go through depression and people can just not know it, because you can put your face on whatever that face is, get through the day, but inside you've still got the broken arm. It's just not
exactly
not visible.
And imagine consider the impact of not getting the help you need for a broken arm, / not getting the help you need for depression or anxiety or an eating disorder or a substance kind of addiction. You know, the kind of the self stigma that we kind of see quite often is also just as destructive. There's someone that, you know, is kind of applying self-stigma to themselves. They might be reluctant to admit they have a problem. This might mean that they postpone seeking help or admitting that they're unwell. They could feel extra distressed. They could particularly feel extra isolated if they're not getting the help they need. And then, you know, the worry is that they would continue to suffer from discrimination after recovery. And I think this is especially, you know, we have a whole different arena and laws in yachting that are not applicable we have laws in England, the Mental Health Act, all of that kind of stuff. Mental health illness is now covered under the Disability Act. And we don't have that as much in yachting. We're not as protected. So, you know, someone who leaves or has to take some time off a boat because they're suffering from a mental illness might have that real worry that they wouldn't get their job back, or it might go on their CV and be almost, and I'm kind of doing air quotes when I say, a stain on their CV, which is a real problem that we have to address in the industry.
Yeah, because I think that's a very real and in some cases true aspect of it. You know, we had a discussion last year about mental health, and one of the crew recruitment agents, you know, honestly said, there's so many CVs coming in. Yeah, if somebody has had a period of mental health illness, I might look at it differently. Where, you know, on the other side, when we're talking to a captain, for those that have understood it and can see that somebody's recovered, in some ways, what isn't always understood is when somebody has truly recovered from an incident because they've had enough time to get the help and care and support they need, very often they can come back, as you know yourself, much wiser, stronger people when they've been able to take that time off. And I think that that's not necessarily seen. It's seen more as the stigma of something negative.
Absolutely, definitely. And to be honest, like I've never been a captain, but I have hired people in the past. I'd actually rather know going into a work environment what I'm dealing with. What is, like, tell me everything. Tell me all the good things about you, all the bad things about you. And then I go into that scenario fully equipped to deal with it. And I think, like I said, because people are, and this is in yachting and the wider society, we're not just going to pick on yachting today, but because people are too frightened to admit it, or they don't want to say what's kind of going on behind the scenes, because it might impact their job potential or their earning potential, they hide it. And then these problems kind of compound on boats, because you then add the stress of being away from home, long working hours, maybe kind of like conflict on the boat that doesn't get any resolution. So all of those things kind of go into a melting pot of yachting life. And then you do start to see cracks. You do start to see an over-reliance of drinking or substance abuse or eating disorders or over-exercising or shutting down and withdrawing. And to be honest, I'd rather know all of that kind of going into a scenario, especially like, you know, high intensity scenarios like crossing oceans, where people are going to be stuck on a boat and not be able to get off and not be able to kind of get away or escape from whatever the, you know, is going on in their heads. I just think the more we talk, the more we understand, and the better equipped we are to deal with all of these problems going in.
Yeah. As you were chatting, I was thinking of, I've had some lovely chats recently with captains, and synonymous through my talks with captains, they've been talking about the importance of mentorship and the importance of crew dynamics. And, you know, it, in some ways, starting a relationship on a boat where you are going to be living and working with people, it would be great to have that honesty, because then you know where you're starting from and you can build those relationships. And certainly in the case of the captains I've talked to, you know, they're leaders in their industry. But a lot of the reason when I've talked to them is because of the people they are and the importance they see in the dynamics of their crew, which comes to, you know, and all of them have said the importance of good communication, and good communication is based on trust and knowing people.
Definitely. Absolutely. Trust is the number one word there. 100%. If you have trust in the person you're talking to, and I mean, not every single person on a boat is the kind of person that you would want to know everything about you. There's concentric circles of people that you allow into your life, and how much how much information you give them is dependent on how trustworthy they are, how comfortable you feel with them, and you know, what you're prepared to give. So any captain or any head of department or any crew member that understands that, I think, is such a credit to themselves and the industry. And there are, you know, I've done crossings with captains, and they've recognized, you know, that this is a high stress environment, and some people just don't cope with it so well. And how would you predict that going in? So we did an initiative on a couple of boats, which I thought was really clever, whereby if you had any conditions or anything kind of medication that you hadn't admitted to because you thought it was going to be a negative impact on the boat. So say you were taking antidepressants and you didn't want to admit that. What they asked us to do is they asked us to write down any conditions or any medications we were taking, and then to put it into a sealed envelope and sign the back of the envelope with our signature. And this would sit, it would be in the captain's cabin. It would not be opened unless something happened to us, unless, you know, and I've had scenarios like this where we've done crossings and people have locked themselves into cabin and they've had kind of like real mental breaks because of the conditions and the stresses that they found themselves at sea during these kind of like 6 weeks passages from Galapagos down to Tahiti. And, you know, what only in the case of emergency, breaking case of emergency, would they ever open that envelope? And if nothing happened at the end of the crossing, you got your envelope up, you could tear it up, you knew it was absolutely safe. And that kind of like kind of installing something like that showed me that the captain was understanding the stresses and pressures on an individual and doing something to make them feel safe and doing something to make the whole boat safe as a result, which I thought was fabulous. And it just kind of underutilized. It should be on a lot more boats than just the ones I've been on, I thought.
Yeah, because ultimately, you know, it respects privacy, but it gives a security if, you know, because for some people, I certainly don't know how I would react on a 6 week crossing. I probably would get quite seasick, actually. But, you know, you will have people who are having a first experience of something or different moments. And to have something that you ultimately know what care they need, because that's the other thing. You know, if you're on a 6 week crossing or whatever, you don't have the local GP or hospital just down the road. So I think to have that extra layer of protection is also really important.
Definitely. And like we've said before, you know, as yachties, we accept the limitations of the environment that we're going into when we go into a crossing. We do firefighting because there is no firefighter coming to rescue us in the middle of the Atlantic or the middle of the Pacific. We do first aid because we know there's no ambulance that's going to be able to get the trip out there and be able to help us, and no helicopters at a certain point. We do sea survival. We equip ourselves with all of this brilliant knowledge that is actionable and applicable to the scenarios we find ourselves. So we just think that the natural extension of that is also to deal with mental health first aid. And, you know, with mental health first aid, it's exactly like physical first aid. You will not be a doctor after a 2-day first aid course, but you will be able to promote recovery, prevent further harm, and provide comfort. So if we can do that in the physical sense, we can also do it in a mental sense.
Indeed. So Emma, if we look a bit more focused on kind of the yachting experience,
yeah,
can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the perception from the outside certainly is that yachties are these fun-loving, you know, travel the world, very often wonderful experience. And yet life on board can be that and certainly is filled with great experiences, but there is a reality to every job that is different to how it appears.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's like it is a job, although it's a job with great salaries and great travel potential and the, you know, looks fabulous on Instagram stories and all of that kind of stuff. But the reality is it's hard work, as every yachtie knows. There's 1,000 memes out there, like what I actually do and what my friends think I do or what my parents think I do. So I think there's this kind of I think the perception from the outside is that we have these fabulous sun-filled lives and we don't do much work. It's like being on permanent holiday. But from the inside, the perception is like, it's really, really hard work, but that's fine. I don't think anyone gets into it and kind of, you know, doesn't understand that it's hard work and it requires quite a lot of self-sacrifice. I think the more problematic perception that I'd like to address is that everyone thinks that you have to be like an extrovert, an outgoing crew member, someone that's fabulous and fun and can drink you under the table and get up and work hard the next day. And, you know, it doesn't always exist. You can't have all of those people. There's being introverted and being extroverted. And both of them, I think, have amazing qualities. And I just want to kind of highlight, like, I don't know if you understand, you obviously have done some research into this, but like the difference between introverted and extroverted. From a psychological perspective, it's not just that you are outgoing or you stay at home. It's actually about how you recharge your batteries. So an introvert recharges their batteries by being alone, by kind of just taking some time out, by like kind of spending some quality time with themselves just to recharge their batteries. And then they kind of, once they're full, they're ready to go. So you can have a really outgoing introvert. I'm saying this passionately because I think that's what I am.
I know a few of those love going- related to them too.
Yeah. 100%. And they are like, obviously they are the most fun people, but when it comes to kind of like downtime, I'm really happy taking myself off and finding a little corner of the boat where I can curl up with a book, take some time out, listen to music, listen to a podcast, read my book. And then once I've kind of recharged my batteries, I am there. Like I'm ready to have fun and go out and do all of those fabulous things. And then an extrovert is from the kind of psychological sense is someone that, that recharges their batteries through the connection with others. So they don't need those downtimes as much. They're kind of, they're out, they're recharging their batteries through connection with others. And they also have a huge amount of benefits and they've got all that kind of fabulousness coming out, but you can't have an industry that's just full of one type of person. It just doesn't make sense. So I think it's really important to kind of understand that it exists on a spectrum. And also, I don't know, we talked about maybe your kids, you've got like one or the other, but it doesn't, to me, it doesn't exist that you're one or the other. It kind of exists like, you know, being tall or fat. You're not just tall or short or fat or thin. There's a whole kind of degree between those. And I think that's the same with introvert and extrovert. You can be somewhere in the middle. And most people, if you look at a kind of like bell curve, most people are probably in that middle. You'll have some extreme introverts and you'll have some extreme extroverts. But most of us find ourselves kind of hanging around the middle, like the norm.
Yeah, being so- a bit the both. And I mean, I was sort of saying this to you, I think it's an interesting time with lockdown, you know, because I think the introverts are probably finding it easier than the extroverts who really need just, they need that social engagement where the introverts tend to, they need it too, but not in the same way, not in the same way, as you said, to recharge your batteries.
Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, we're not, there's no judgment on either. An introvert kind of says, I need some time for myself. An extrovert says, I love being around other people. Both are fabulous. As long as you understand that, and as long as there's no stigma attached to being an introvert on a yacht.
I was going to say, I think that's exactly where there is, though. I mean, particularly with the younger group, I think there is a stigma if you are more an introvert, because being the, we've even seen it since Friends, you know, the most sociable people were the popular ones, you know, it's sort of reinforced all the time that the extroverts are the popular ones, the introverts are the kind of more geeky ones or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, personally, from my experience, I love being around people that are authentic. If someone's kind of trying too hard, or if I can tell that they're doing things that they think are meant to be done, or they think that are cool, that you can see that. You can sense a vibe of someone not being authentic. And those are not the kind of people I really want to hang around with. I'm really happy with the person that kind of is comfortable in themselves, owns their own personality, owns what they've got. And if they're comfortable, it makes me more comfortable. So yeah, I think they're a wonderful addition to yachts.
I'm wondering whether there's also an age factor in that as well. You know, I think as we get older, we worry less what other people think, which is one of the nice advantages of age, to be honest. And, you know, very often we're kind of more comfy in our skins because we've got to know each other longer. Another advantage of age, you know, the youth don't definitely have them all. And so that actually ties in nicely with the concept of toxic personalities, of people who, the personalities of people are very, very important and emphasized even more so, I think, on a yacht where you are, you know, in that contained space, sometimes for weeks or working for weeks on end.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the biggest thing is no escape. You know, if you have a kind of toxic personality at work in London or in Dublin, wherever you find yourself, at the end of the day, you know, in the old days, obviously, you would kind of like shut your computer down, leave your chair, walk out the office, and that person would be gone. They'd be out of your life for the next, you know, 12 to 14 hours. You would go then surround yourself with your tribe, whether that's your family or your friends that you go drinking and hang out with or go to, like all of the social events. So that kind of that closing the door to that toxic personality is a really fundamental, important point. And it's part of the survival. You know, you'll be able to kind of do that job a lot longer and be more successful and better suited to that job if you're able to escape that person. If you're not, like we find ourselves quite often on boats, if that person, and it might not just be that they're an aggressor or an abuser or they're harassing you, it might just be that there's a personality clash. But if there's a personality clash,
can I say even more surreptitious kind of toxic personality, you know, that kind of person that somehow makes you feel smaller but you don't really know how because they're not saying anything directly. It's more surreptitious. I kind of find them, it can take longer to recognize that person where more brash type, but somehow you walk away and you feel drained or you feel smaller or, and you can't put your finger on it. Yeah, they didn't say anything that mean. I don't know why. I just feel, I'm thinking toxic personalities aren't necessarily the most obvious ones.
Yeah. And I think a big thing that's maybe kind of occurs in yachting is that it might not just be so overt like we were saying before, it also might be kind of exclusion. So that kind of like doing crew days out but not inviting people, or doing kind of certain things and just not inviting people, that kind of that feeling really kind of settles on certain people and then kind of gets absorbed into the relationship. So I mean, you're not going to be able to get on with every single person on a boat forever and ever, amen. That's just not how we're made up. But kind of accepting that, you know, it's okay not to have brilliant relationships with every single person on board. And it's even more important, it's okay not to change yourself in order to fit in on the boat. If you're going to have to change yourself from an introvert to an extrovert, or you're going to have to change yourself into a big drinker or someone that kind of parties all night, and that's just not you, it's got a really short timeline on it. You won't be able to sustain that. And the only person you're going to end up damaging is yourself, because you're not being true to yourself. And that's something that I'd really like people to take away from this kind of conversation, is the more comfortable and the more authentic that you are with yourself and what every kind of brilliance that you bring into being on a boat, just recognize that and just be comfortable in it. And naturally, I think everyone else will start to kind of like your tribe will gravitate towards you. The ones that are more going out will hang out, and the ones that are more kind of into water sports will do water sports. The ones that are into exercise will all go into exercise. And just finding your little tribe on the boat will be like, I don't know, it'll just be like coming home, I think. And that's fabulous. That's what it is. It is our home as well as our workplace, and you need to be comfortable where you are.
Well, and I think that's also sort of some of the advice I've heard back is sometimes a boat just won't suit you. You will try your hardest, but it's just not the right fit. And that maybe it's good to recognize that as well, that occasionally it just won't be the right fit. And you're better to look for the job that fits you right, because that's got a lot more longevity than to try and mold yourself, as the expression goes, a round peg in a square hole. Or is it the other way around? Square peg in a round hole. There you go. I always get them backwards.
And you're absolutely right. But again, I think this is growing older and also getting more experience, getting more comfortable in yachting, understanding how the yachting industry works. And as you get older and as you get wiser and as you get more experience, you will be able to make those decisions more confidently. Like, you know what? This boat is not my boat. These people are not my people. I'm gonna walk away, stay friends with everyone, keep those bridges kind of going, and just find another boat. Find people that are more suited to me. And I think actually, like, a really amazing evolution that I've seen in yachting is that when people are being interviewed, they do ask more of those kind of questions. questions like how do you socialize, where do you go, what are your interests? And a boat that is, you know, highly charged and likes to go out will want more people like themselves to come on, and a boat that's more focused on exercise and healthy eating and nutrition and all getting up together and doing HIIT sessions, they'll say that in interviews, and people can either go, yep, that's me, that sounds brilliant, or no, that's not me, and move on. So we're making those brilliant steps forward. We've just got to keep the progression going in the way it's going.
Just as, I mean, we kind of touched on age, but mental health affects all ages, as we know. And is there, if we could look at perhaps the stigma that captains or senior crew might feel if they start to have an issue, because, you know, they have a huge amount of responsibility, they're responsible for other people, and it can hit us just the same way. What's your kind of perception on that? Is there a extra pressure on them? And you know, what's wrong with me? I'm, you know, 40, whatever, or I'm 50, whatever. I shouldn't be feeling this way. Or middle-age crisis. No, I don't necessarily do that.
Yeah, I think there definitely is. And I think there's also part of the stigma is that men don't really talk about their feelings. They don't have open conversation with other men about this kind of stuff. So the chances are, and just the way that yachting is set up, it is more men that are captains. It is more men that are chief officers and head of departments. So that is a real kind of concern. And I don't really know what to say here, because it kind of just, it's devastating that, you know, guys are going through this and not find the avenues in which that they can kind of talk openly or talk freely. Again, there's little changes being made. I know there's captains out there that are starting to have conversations in captains groups about mental health, which is brilliant, because that's what we need to do to break the stigma, is be open, be authentic, and have conversations. And, you know, I've never, ever, ever had an open, authentic conversation with an older person or a captain or a head of departments about my own struggles, and ever been met with kind of derision or misunderstanding, or kind of like, you know, they just wanted to wash their hands of me. Most conversations, when you're open and honest about stuff, you're kind of either met with two things. You're met with admiration, or because they just think, you know, well done, you've survived, and thank you so much for telling me. Or you are met with a kind of a silence followed by, you know, those feelings we're talking about, I've definitely felt that, or I've got a friend who feels that, or my brother actually, you know, he suffered with it. And once I've told my story, it just opens doors to so many people telling their stories. And that's what I find so incredible about this kind of where this direction has taken me, from just being a yacht chef to now being a yacht chef that delivers mental health first aid training, is the conversations I'm having are incredible. And I think with a lot of these older yachties, and specifically male older yachties, is this might be the first time they're ever talking about it. And the sense of relief is just enormous. Like, their whole body language changes, their posture changes, the shoulders that have been kind of tight up around the ears suddenly start to drop, because they're saying things that have been going around in their heads, and now they're getting some airtime. And I mean, I don't know if you've ever had like thoughts that kind of ruminate in your head over and over and over and over again. You almost get kind of so overwhelmed by them. It's only when you say them out loud that you start to get some clarity about actually what am I feeling, and how is this, and what is it doing to affect me, and all of this kind of stuff. And I think for those guys that have those conversations, that feeling of relief is enormous, and also just overdue. It was just overdue. The conversation was overdue. And that's the horrible thing about stigma, is that it shouldn't be like that. And it can change.
Well, that's why I was, you know, thinking of the, let's say, older generation in yachting, you know, and I kind of would put 40 to 70. They definitely grew up in a world where, you know, for their parents' generation, suicide was outlawed. Mental health wasn't really talked about or understood that well. I mean, the leaps and bounds of our understanding and our ability to effectively medicate, the whole concept of counseling has, you know, yes, it was there 30 or 40 years ago, but it wasn't there for everybody. So, you know, there's a whole generation that grew up in a world that mental health wasn't talked about in the same way. And certainly there was a lot of shame involved in their generation of all aspects of mental health.
Definitely. I mean, there were so many barriers to recovery. You know, you had stigma, maybe access to services, money. It would have been quite expensive to get help for counseling. I mean, it's still quite expensive now. There would have been cultural stigma, you know, people coming from a different, like people of color, coming from different religion backgrounds, they would have had stigma, maybe incorrect diagnosis or a bad therapy experience. There's a fatalism, like I said before, this kind of fatalistic permanence that's attached to mental ill health that we haven't shaken off as a society yet, that once you are mentally ill, you will always be mentally ill. Like once you have had a diagnosis of depression or anxiety, that is that's what defines you as a human being, not the fact that you're a captain or a chef or a wife or a husband or a mother or a brother. All of that goes out the window when someone hears the word depression, suicidal, psychosis, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's a real shame.
And even with the bigger issues, you know, be it bipolar or schizophrenia,
yeah,
there's not a fatal path necessarily on that. You know, there's plenty of very high functioning, brilliant people who will have their own stories of their discovery of mental health, but are incredible in the other things that they have achieved or very often used it as a strength. I mean, that's one of the when I was studying about psychiatry and depression, and one of the books I found as I was kind of researching was called The Wisdom of Depression. And it was a very simple book. It had, you know, helpful tools of looking at diet and exercise. But the premise of the book was that depression is for many people, a natural progress in life. It's like grief. One in four people, as we know, will suffer from depression. Yeah. But depression serves its own purpose because it makes you stop. And, you know, you may not want to stop, you may not. But if you are depressed, very often you will need to stop and reflect or resolve or change something. And as a result, when you get to the other side, you know, you have this wisdom of having gone through this process. And I love this book because up until this point, depression had always been, for me, was something that, oh, you don't want to be depressed. It's a negative thing. But if you can look at it as a part of life's journey that will bring you greater wisdom, it becomes a positive thing. So tilting our mindset of how we perceive what we go through, I think, is a big part of it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, depression gives you... that, you know, when you've recovered from a real bad, long illness, you know, maybe you've been in bed for quite a while, you haven't been able to eat or you haven't been able to, you know, use your hands. When you finally get that back, when you can kind of like sit up and look out the window, like how beautiful is that world? You know, you start to see everything with fresh eyes, you start to appreciate everything a bit more. And it's the same when you've kind of survived anything like depression, or you've had a bout of anxiety, or maybe you've had a suicidal ideation, period of suicidal ideation. For me personally, I thought it gave me a really unique view on the world that other people might not have had. It also gives me a great deal of empathy with others who are struggling with difficult life events, and has been part of the reason I've made this like change in my career. Having kind of been at the coalface of depression and panic attacks and all kinds of different things, there's a real difference between sympathy and empathy. And I would encourage people, there's a brilliant talk by Brené Brown. She talks about the difference between sympathy and empathy. It's just a kind of like 5-minute video. And having lived through things and having experienced it and having that lived experience and understanding of it, I no longer apply sympathy, which she defines as kind of driving connection away from people. Because you say things when you're being sympathetic, you're like, you say a lot of terms and phrases like, oh, well, at least, you know, if someone's had a miscarriage, well, at least, you know, you can get pregnant. If someone is, you know, going through a divorce, well, at least you've been married. You know what I mean? There's all these kind of like phrases that actually drives connection, whereas empathy is much more just kind of sitting, listening, and taking on that person's experiences. And I see that as one of the benefits that you're talking about, is coming through the other side. I'm a much kinder person to myself. I'm a much kinder person to the people around me. I'm a much kinder person to society. And I probably wouldn't have got that if I just kind of like traipsed through life without any of the experiences that I've had. I wear them as a badge of honor now. You know, I got through a lot in my life and I'm quite proud of that.
No, it's a wonderful reflection, you know, that it can end up being a positive strength, even though the perception initially is negative. It does change you. And for most people, it changes you to appreciate things for the better or become a better person and push you through a process of change that you probably need to go through. It just, in some ways, accelerates the process.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the thing that kind of saved me is that when I was kind of going through my worst period, there was a girl in yachting. I was on a boat. I had suffered from depression, undiagnosed for 3 years. 18 months of those, I've been kind of having daily multiple suicide thoughts. You know, suicide occurs on a continuum. So, you know, you'll have no thoughts, then you might have fleeting thoughts, then you'll have persistent thoughts, and then you start to think of a plan, maybe a method that you would do it, even a time, and then you would and at each point you can kind of go up and down the continuum. You can have fleeting thoughts and then go back to no thoughts, or you can go to persistent thoughts and go back to no thoughts. And I was really kind of at the end. I'd come up with a time, I had thought of a plan, I had my method and everything like this, and the only person I could ever talk about it with was a girl who had been brilliantly open and honest and authentic about her mental breakdown. And she's just this fabulous, intelligent, erudite, dynamic human being. She's a kind of like a female Russell Brand. Like, she's tall and long-limbed and uses words I have to look up in dictionaries daily. And when I kind of got to the end point where I just thought, this is it, it's going to happen, the only person I thought I could talk about it to was the other person that had been honest and open about their experiences. And as soon as I said the words out loud, she kind of sprung into action and got me off the boat, got me into like a place in France where I could see a therapist, where I was looked after, got me like sorted out all of the time off work that I needed from the boat, explained everything to them, what was going on, without any shame, any discrimination, any stigma attached, just really matter of fact, like, this is what it is, this is what's going to happen, this is how I see it playing out. And, you know, I'm just letting you know this is the plan for Emma. And because of that, I'm here today. And because of that, I am able to tell my story. Like, having conversations and raising awareness and breaking that stigma is definitely the reason that I didn't complete suicide, for sure. That's how important it is. Because suicide is, I mean, I hate to like make an obvious statement, but it's fatal, really is. And it's preventable. That's the most heartbreaking part about it. You know, if someone suffers from a heart attack or they're involved in a car accident or any of that kind of stuff, you know, you kind of, as a physical first aider, you're dealing with a situation in front of you and thinking, geez, okay, like trying to remember your ABCs and your mnemonics and all of this kind of stuff. With suicide and depression and anxiety, early intervention is vital, as we found out anecdotally, and evidence kind of has taught us that. And it's preventable. Suicide is preventable loss of life, which is the point I really, really want people to kind of understand. So, yeah, this is why it's so important to talk about.
Absolutely. I just add to it for a story I heard recently, which was my brother-in-law had a friend who rung him at that moment, and he he said, you're not to tell anyone. You're the last person I'm going to phone before I have put my plan in action. And you're my last phone call. And basically said, but I don't want you to notify anyone or tell anyone. And my brother-in-law hung up the phone and he was like, what do I do? And my sister kind of turned to him and said, well, look, you've lost a friend either which way. So do what you can do. The end of the story was that he phoned the emergency. He contacted family. The guy got help and went on to, you know, meet somebody else and now has a family. I think that, and I'm taking that as kind of the final point, but my point is it's never too late to help someone. And that moment of when people get very close to that point, it's a very vulnerable time where they can't see things clearly because they're in such a dark place. And that they do, you know, for those that are kind of wondering, what do I do if I'm worried about someone? I would encourage everyone to, you know, find a way to step in, because when somebody's getting to that point, they really need the help to guide them out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's what we talk about in mental health first aid. You are going to meet people in life that need help in a crisis situation, whether that's depression or a panic attack from anxiety, or, you know, at that, the other end of the scale, like suicide. What we teach people is that you're more likely to meet someone that's going through a mental health crisis than you are a car accident or having a heart attack or having a stroke on the street. And knowing how to approach that person, how to assess them, how to assist them, this is all part of the teaching that we do in mental health first aid. We just like physical first aid, we have the mnemonics, we have a 5-point approach that you would look at when dealing with someone either going through suicide crisis or anxiety crisis or depression, and just having that information, knowing what has been proven to help, what to say, what to do, how to assist that person is so empowering. It feels like you've got a tiny little, like, you know, superpower, because you actually know how to save someone's life in the same way as you know how to do that when you've learned how to do your ABCs, your airways, your breathing, and your circulation. Yeah. So, yeah. I'm so glad at the end of that story. But yes, that was the right thing to do. You always, there's no keeping a promise when it comes to suicide, because you just can't make those promises. You have to get someone else involved. And if you've got no one else and you don't know what to do, I mean, 999 is... that's what they're there for.
It is just, you know, for all of us, even you were talking about statistics and everything else in Ireland, just to throw another statistic, 1 in 3 people will have a friend who has some sort of mental health problem. And I think that speaks, even though, you know, we know 1 in 4 people, it speaks of everybody knows somebody somewhere in their circle who has something going on. And so our ability to have the right tools to help our friends as they, or family or colleagues, as they're going through something, is actually, you know, very much an important life tool.
Absolutely. And I'd go further and say we know multiple people that are going through life events, especially now. I mean, COVID is the elephant in the room. We've gone through a pandemic. All of the kind of isolation, loneliness, potential kind of depression that's sprung up from losing jobs. And this might not affect Yossies as much, because it is an industry that's had a fair amount of insulation from that. But maybe not getting home, you know, not being able to travel because you know that you can't go back to South Africa. I'm South African, so obviously there's the South African variant out there that is restricting a lot of travel. Maybe knowing that people are home and you can't be there for them. Those are all going to be kind of seeping into our brains and accumulating, and they've got to go somewhere. Those feelings and those thoughts have to go somewhere. So I would venture to say that we know multiple people that are going through mental health issues and potentially crisis. It's just we're not having the conversations enough to have an understanding of what those numbers really, truly reflect.
Yeah, And to bring us back to our, you know, original topic is to break the stigma. And the only way to break the stigma is to be open, not just in a greater industry, which, you know, we hope it'll ripple onto, but to start by that on our own platform, be it ourselves, be it the boat we work on, wherever you are.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, reduced stigma, raise awareness, start conversations, and number one, improve your own health and well-being.
Indeed. Well, Emma, that will bring me on to multiple other topics, which I'm delighted to say we will be talking about over this series bit by bit, and looking at different aspects of mental health and how we can work it into our lives to have it as a positive influence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I'm looking forward to catching up. Please stay tuned. We will be doing this as a regular series. It will be available on broadcast on Super Yacht Radio and on podcast. And for any information that we talk about, or actually additional information to the subjects we're talking about, we will also have links on our websites for that information. And of course, if you want to know more about mental health training and Kelly's calls, please get in touch with Emma. Would you like to give some details, Emma?
Yeah, absolutely. You can get hold of me. My email is emma@kellyscause.com. And we also have a website. If you search for Kelly's Cause Foundation, and within that website, if you look for the Seize the Mind button, that's a yachting specific resource that we've created for mental health first aid training for yachties and boats out there. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And stay well, stay safe.
This is Super Yacht Radio.